All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. It keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the wheat genome. In a warming world, wheat DNA is a gold mine.
We always knew that we needed to sequence this material, but it was incredibly intimidating because the wheat genome is 17 gigabases. We would have been paying $10 or $15 million. And this guy, who's the director of the institute in Shenzhen, just stood up and said, "We're going to work with the John Innes Center to sequence their entire wheat collection."
At the International Court of Justice in The Hague, Israel's never-ending occupation of Palestine has been declared illegal.
This will now be a centerpiece of virtually every General Assembly and Human Rights Council resolution from now on. The word illegal will be in front of occupation from now on.
Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Wheat, genus Triticum. It's a grass, a cereal cultivated around the world for its grain across vast swaths of land. Lots of wheat grain grown and traded around the world every day, ending up in flour, bread, pita, and pasta, alongside corn and rice. It's a food staple for human beings here on planet Earth. Wheat has come a long way since humans began cultivating it 10,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent. Of the dozens of species of wheat, Triticum estivum is the most commonly grown these days. Since the launch of the Green Revolution 60 years ago, wheat has come to be bred for just a half dozen traits, best suited for mass production, yield being the most crucial. The payoff has been huge. Wheat accounts for an estimated fifth of the calories Earth's 8,123,000,000 people consume each and every day. But success also breeds frailty. In a warming world, highly inbred wheat is poorly adapted to heat stress, and stressed wheat is more vulnerable to pathogens and pests. Now, plant geneticists are combing through wheat's huge genetic source code, its genome, in search of incredibly useful traits lost by the wayside over the past 100 years, and the genes that code for them. At the John Innes Center in the UK, researchers are drilling down into the DNA of wheat varieties gathered from fields around the world by a very inquisitive man named Arthur Watkins. It's a gold mine. Simon Griffiths leads the effort. The GPM reached out to Simon Griffiths in Norwich, England. Hello, Simon Griffiths. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hi, David. Nice to meet you.
Simon, you've referred to this collection of wheat varieties that Arthur Watkins collected 100 years ago and has been sitting at the John Innes Center as a gold mine. And, of course, gold is precious. People make a lot of money buying and trading gold. What makes lost wheat varieties precious, so valuable?
Well, if we take a really simple model for how progress is made in breeding to produce the varieties of all crops that feed the world, and, you know, it's not too dramatic a thing to say feed the world, because, you know, the global staples are really wheat, maize, and rice, and, you know, with a few things not far behind, like potatoes. And, yeah, they feed us, and they feed the animals that we eat. And when the kind of genetic progress that has been made in those crops is spectacular. So for many traits and characteristics, so if you take the easiest one to understand, which is yield, so the weight of a crop produced on a unit area of land, the increases that we've seen in the past 50 years historically have been completely unprecedented. But they, all of those have been produced by shuffling the genetic playing cards, you know? That's what breeders do. They keep shuffling the pack until they get better and better hands. And just like in playing cards, there's a ceiling to that. So eventually you're going to deal yourself a running flush. And the varieties of today are getting close to a running flush.
Meaning we're losing variety.
Well, not just that, but we're losing the potential for improvement. You're hitting the ceiling, the glass ceiling, because the year, you know, you're maxing out on several traits, and then you get the best combinations of the variation that you've got, the genes and alleles, and it's hard to keep improving. And if you go back to when breeding began systematically, that's really the late 19th and early 20th century. You know, they took the land races, that's, you know, the material that farmers grew, the heritage variety, heritage types of crops were called land races, still are. And then breeders took them and they crossed them with each other. And then they took the best progeny and then they crossed them with their siblings. And that gives farmers improved performance on the farm. But after that starts, you lose diversity because the founders of that event become enriched in the modern varieties. And just by chance, the ones they didn't include in those early selections, they're left behind. But they still contain lots of genes and alleles which would contribute to better wheat today, or any crop, the better crop. So it's just by chance they were left behind.
Tell me about Arthur Watkins. Who was Arthur Watkins? And, of course, the Innes Centre, and how the John Innes Centre came to acquire Arthur Watkins' collection of wheat.
So you're getting deep into kind of an intertwined history of UK plant science and breeding and genetics history here, where Arthur Watkins was, he ended up working at the University of Cambridge, which at that time had an agriculture department. Now, the University of Department of Cambridge no longer has an agriculture department. It closed while Watkins was there. And they all moved out to a new institute called the Plant Breeding Institute in Cambridge. And it was to improve varieties. And this, I think the historical context is important here. You know, why is Britain opening a plant breeding institute? Well, of course, there's population growth, the issues of national security, maximum use of crop resources across the British Empire. So a very kind of imperial view of things as well. And they need to use the new laws of genetics to produce improved varieties, better crops. So Watkins was part of that. You know, he'd fought in the First World War and was not a farmer, particularly interested in agriculture, but became interested in agriculture because the British Army left him in France to look after the horses from the trenches. And then from there, he develops an interest in agriculture. He joined the University of Cambridge department and then the Plant Breeding Institute. And then, of course, wheat, as it is now, wheat was the UK's major crop. And he wanted just to understand more about it. And he could see that the kind of titans of wheat research at the time, so really famous names in genetics like Bateson and Biffen, you know, Bateson invented the word genetics. Biffen was the person who really, the father of wheat breeding in the UK. So they were the big hitters. But Watkins was actually not a famous scientist. But he had a great idea. To make the collection, he wanted to use the kind of mechanisms of Britain at the time, which was empire and consulates, embassies, the army. So, of course, you had garrisons everywhere. And he wrote to all these people, and the letters are great. I like looking at the archive. And he would write the letters out to people and say, just send me some wheat. But very nicely, in the letters, what he says is, Mendel's laws have been rediscovered. I can see the breeders around me selecting new improved varieties. And this is our chance to sample the world diversity for wheat as it's grown now.
So he was observing people in different places around the world who were selecting wheat varieties. Many of them were farmers?
No. So it would have been the people selecting the new varieties would be in these relatively fancy new institutes. So, you know, even in like Morocco, North Africa, the French would have breeding institutes. The British had, in India, they established Pusa, and they're still here to this day, these national centres, and they began the modern science of plant breeding. Watkins said, don't go anywhere near those places. Go to the local markets, go to the farmers, and select what they're, and take what they're growing. And that's what they did, and he received these packets of seed from all over the world, lots from China, India.
And these were farmers' varieties?
Exactly, what people were eating then. And he absolutely didn't want the new varieties. He wanted the landraces.
Huh, and so they arrived in England in envelopes?
Yeah, and it's funny, in the letters you read it where he'll send a letter back to some soldier in India and says, well, thanks for all the packets, but it's all barley. Which shows you the lack of expertise in the people selecting it. And he'd get this apologetic letter from the from the soldiers, and they'd say, oh, sorry, and then they'd send him some wheat.
So the John Innes Centre, so fast forward, all these seeds were being stored at the John Innes Centre.
Eventually, yeah, because, as I say, Cambridge closed the agriculture department, he moved to the Plant Breeding Institute. The Plant Breeding Institute became really one of the most successful breeding centres in the world, and very famous, and had 70% of the varieties in the UK, I think, if not more. But then it was closed because Margaret Thatcher came to power in the 80s, and it was a public breeding institute. Of course, it was central to the doctrine of the Conservative Party at the time that industry was privatised. So they privatised UK plant breeding in the late 1980s. When they did that, the breeding went to companies like Unilever and Monsanto, but the research part of it came to Norwich and what was at the time the John Innes Institute. And actually the reason it's not the John Innes Institute anymore is because the merger of the PBI with John Innes is a huge deal, brought in a lot of staff and money to the John Innes Institute, and that's when it became the John Innes Centre.
And so this collection, what does the... I mean, before you started to work with your Chinese colleagues to sequence the genome, sequence the DNA in these seed varieties, what did the collection look like? Were they in paper envelopes inside drawers?
That's a great question. So so envelopes in cold storage. So we store, for longevity and accessibility, we store seeds at very dry and dry environments. So we dehumidify down to a very low level, and then we keep the temperature, I think, at 2 degrees in our seed store. In many places, you'll find it's actually a freezer, so you'll walk in at minus 20. But it's more of a working seed store at John Innes, so we go for that compromise. The main thing is that it's dry and steady. And in those environments, we can keep wheat at a very high viability for 8 years.
And these are seeds. These are seeds inside envelopes, and they're assiduously labeled.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And in the old days, so before refrigeration and dehumidification, they would be multiplying every 3 years. So since Watkins assembled the material in the 20s and 30s, every 3 years, the whole material collection would be multiplied in the field, seed saved, and then moved back.
So I was going to ask you this. So at the center, at this point, before you started to get into the genomics, were you growing these seeds? Were you multiplying them?
Oh, yeah. So the reason, if you think about it, The coming for this project where we've sequenced the Watkins collection, there's other collections that the Chinese team could have collaborated with. But the thing that we'd done, which we think added so much value to the project, was to take the Watkins collection and then we genotyped it. So we assessed not the full sequence, but a set of markers that allowed us to say how diverse it was. And we developed a core set. So a core set is the sample that you can produce which you think captures most of the diversity.
120 seeds.
Yeah, seeds, accessions. I mean, they're actually landraces, they're almost populations in themselves, because when farmers grew landraces, it was very rarely as one type of wheat. It would often be a heterogeneous mixture. So we had that, but we purified single seeds from that, as you say. We took the 120, and then to do genetics on it, we crossed it with a modern wheat variety. And for each one of them, we had 94 individuals, which basically dissect the genome. of each of the core set. So if you can imagine a big kind of pyramid in your mind, where at the bottom there's the Watkins collection, 827. And then from the 827, we make a core set of 120. And from the 120, each of them then expands again into a population of 94. So it adds up to about 12,000 lines that we phenotype, we collect the trait data for, to discover the genes in the Watkins collection.
And for those who don't know, a genotype is the genetic constitution. It's the It's the collection of alleles or genes, and the phenotype is the look or the trait.
Exactly. And in the days before whole genome sequencing was possible in wheat, we used old-style molecular markers, things called simple sequence repeats.
You would actually take these seeds and digest them and analyze the DNA.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Now, the wheat this gets really, really complicated and interesting. No, this is great. I understand a little bit about it, but it's much of it is beyond me. But I want to hone in on this fact that the wheat genome is huge. The wheat genome is ginormous. It's much bigger than the human genome. Tell me about this.
Yeah, it made me laugh when a U.S. researcher called Jeff Bennetson came over to the JIC to give a talk once, and he referred to these genomes as obese. Because what their gene content is quite similar to other plants, but these plants have much smaller genomes. You know, the famous model organism Arabidopsis just has, you know, a genome of 100 megabases, right? But then the wheat genome is 17 gigabases. It's just orders of magnitude bigger. But the thing that's filled it up are these retroelements. So they are kind of like viruses that hop around in the genome and expand over history.
Transposons?
Transposons, yeah, discovered by Barbara McClintock. And there's different types of transposon. The one that's really common in wheat is they're called retroelements.
And what's the purpose of these retroelements?
Well, it's a great, their purpose is their own purpose. You know, it's expansion. You know, they're passengers in the genome. I mean, nobody really knows why the grasses, for example, had these massive expansions of retroelement activity, but they did in the history. And all that genome is repetitive sequences from this retroelement activity.
So does it add to the diversity of the seed or the diversity?
It does because I say the retroelements are looking after themselves, but they do cause phenotypic changes as well. So if these retroelements and jump near genes or they disrupt genes, then they change the function. And quite a lot of the gain of function mutations we see in wheat happen because a retroelement happens to have jumped into a promoter of a gene or into the intron of a gene. It changes the function.
So I'm thinking that you established that there was a huge diversity and phenotypic diversity, lots and lots of interesting, potentially enormously useful traits in this collection before you actually, your Chinese colleagues sequenced the genomes. What were these traits that you were discovering that were really interesting?
Yeah, we were discovering, so it's probably useful to categorize traits into three types. So there's the things that affect yield, you know, how much seed you get, what weight of seed you get from a particular area. Then there's the ones that affect stress tolerance, and there's either abiotics, stress tolerance, so things like drought, salt, heat, and the biotic, all the diseases. So all the time, you know, you can imagine you've got this high nutrient source in the environment, and lots of fungi and bacteria want to come along, and viruses want to come along and eat it. So there's huge defenses built up in plants against those disease threats.
And you were finding varieties in this collection that fall within each of these three categories.
Exactly.
They were incredibly high yield, or they were really resistant to high temperatures or salt or certain pathogens.
The other important thing there is, of course, the landrace itself. This is this breeding conundrum I was talking about. The landrace itself is never more high yielding, never has higher yields than the modern varieties. But what it contains is genes that allow the modern varieties to become high yielding. So that's why those big families I talked about where we crossed Watkins with modern wheat, that allows us to pinpoint the genes which control yield. And once we've done that, we can take some of them very precisely select them with molecular markers, cross them into modern wheat, and it makes modern wheat even better.
Now, why did you want to have the whole genome, the entire genomes of these various varieties sequenced? And tell me about how you went about actually doing that. And I was reading in the Guardian article about how the Chinese, your Chinese collaborators did this really quickly, and then you got a suitcase full of hard drives with multiple terabytes of data. Tell me about all this.
So the reason we need the sequence, so we started off the work without sequence, you know, where I told you about those old style molecular markers that we used, and we were finding the traits, the increased yield, the disease resistance, adaptation to climate change traits, many, many interesting traits, nutritional traits. But the problem is that the breeders, the people who make the new varieties, would always say, what if I've already got that gene and I don't know about it? I'm just selecting empirically for it already. And you're going to do all this work to cross it into one of my varieties. But actually, it's already in my germplasm, in one of my other lines. So the way to show them that it's not like that is really to actually show them the gene, literally look at the gene sequence and say, no, you haven't got this, it's different. And with that, you do that through sequencing. So we sequence the genome, that's just a load of ATs, Gs and Cs. Then they're assembled in exactly the four letters of the genetic code, but they make amino acids. And you can translate all that and you can see the amino acid sequence, the protein that the gene makes. And then you can see the exact changes that are there in the Watkins collection. So it might be a single base, a single one of the four letter codes that just changes one amino acid. Or it might be a big insertion or deletion of DNA, which changes the way the gene is regulated, which is often outside of the gene itself. In the part upstream of it, there's the gene is it's got a promoter, and we found, for example, lots of deletions in promoters that change the way the genes are regulated, and that those new alleles do something useful.
So tell me about the suitcase filled with hard drives.
Yeah. So that we always knew that we needed to sequence this material, right? But it was incredibly intimidating because, as you've just said, the wheat genome is 17 gigabases. It's full of repetitive DNA, so it's hard to assemble. You know, the cost of sequencing comes down rapidly, but it was still multi-million dollars. The prices we paid, we would have been paying $10 or $15 million, and nobody was going to fund us in the near term to do that, right? So our director at the time, Dale Sanders, was in China as a conference, and this guy who's the director of the Institute in Shenzhen just stood up, and he hadn't spoken to my director. He just stood up and said, we're going to work with the John Innes Center to sequence their entire wheat collection. They were good to their word, and that was San Wen Huang. And San Wen asked my kind of equivalent to Aegis, who's Shifeng Cheng, to email the JC and to firm up this offer. So sure enough, I got the email, and he said, well, what would you start with? And it was no hesitation for me. It was the Watkins collection, which we'd already been working on for, you know, 19 years at that point. And then, so we gave them pure DNA from not the heterogeneous landrace material we talked about, genetically purified representatives of those landraces, which are stored in the gene bank here, extracted the DNA, sent it to Shenzhen. In very short order, the suitcase arrives with the, as you say, with the hard drives and a huge amount of data. I mean, we couldn't, you know, the bioinformatics people here are used to, you know, big data sets. But these are files that you can't open them. They really take a lot of computational expertise to analyze this amount of data.
This is a bit of a tangent, but you know, everybody talks about competing with China. You know, China's some big threat. But here's an astonishing example of incredible collegial cooperation.
Exactly, and there's nothing to lose for us because. If you think about what the Watkins collection is, go back to that, how it was collected. It was highly unethical the way Watkins did it. They just didn't think about things like that back then, you know, that they were just taking national property, which was the local germplasm, and bringing it to the UK. And then that was soon realized when we had the collection here. And we always realized we had to share it completely openly. much of the materials from China. So it doesn't matter who requests the material from us, we will send it to them.
Who owns the Watkins collection? What are the proprietary intellectual property?
So I would say that we are, the JSC is the custodians of the Watkins collection. The owners are the nations it was taken, collected from. So nobody owns the whole thing, but the material that's from China, the Chinese own it. The material, yeah.
That's fascinating. Is there African material in there?
North Africa, yeah. I mean, wheat's really a North African crops, but not sub-Saharan.
I mean, I want to ask, like, how do you put a fine point on that? How is this formalized that China owns the germplasm in the Watkins collection?
Well, that's interesting, because there's an international treaty specifying this now. The point is that the reality of it is that the Watkins collection is fully accessible for anyone to use. If they produce a variety with it and they make some money out of it, then they may have to value share with the country of origin.
Now, some of these traits are now being that you identified before the sequencing happened, and now we know the genes and the gene products, and they can be traced and so on. Like, are these traits now being bred into national wheat varieties in China and India? And tell me about that.
So we do. So we were first in, obviously the project started in the UK, so we had a UK focus, and we have this platform we call the Breeders Toolkit, where we use a process called backcrossing to move the genes very precisely into modern varieties. So we've got the molecular markers which diagnose the presence of the gene, and then we cross it to the modern variety. Then we cross the modern variety with the children of that cross, and we keep doing it. And every time you do that, you dilute the landrace by 50%, and you increase the contribution of the modern variety. But you maintain the presence of this one chunk of landrace which contains the gene by kind of counter selection. You always make sure that the gene is there with a molecular marker.
And so the genes code for protein, so you can actually go in there and detect the presence of the protein in the plant, the wheat plant that's growing.
Exactly. That's the sharp end. The gene makes some kind of protein that does something. It protects the plant from disease, or it increases yield by interacting with some molecular pathway. That's what you've just said there, David, is the sharp end of the actual biology here.
And so these varieties are now being bred back into national.
Yeah.
Or is this just happening in university laboratories or in government institutions, or is it actually happening out in the field?
No, they are getting back into farmers' field. In the UK, as I said, plant breeding is a private endeavor. So we cross this valley of death. So that when the material stays in the university's departments, as you just say, you're on the wrong side of the valley. And it's a big challenge across science, from medical through to, you know, areas such as mine, to get to the other side of the valley, which is application in farmers' fields. Now, the way we do that is to meet in the middle and work with private companies here, where we produce the germplasm. They all vote on the traits and the genes that they find more interesting in a formal committee. Then we produce the material, we test it academically, and if it looks promising still in these, they call them isogenic lines, this material, which is almost the same as the variety, but has this added part, we test it there, and then that goes on to commercial breeding sites. And they use that material in a process called pre-breeding to move the gene into their material. And that is absolutely happening.
And so these genomes, these gene sequences are in the public domain. They're open source.
Exactly.
I want to zoom out as we're nearing the end of our conversation. Why does all this matter? I think a lot of people would they take wheat for granted. It's fascinating that like a fifth of the calories consumed by the 8 billion people living on planet Earth come from wheat, like a fifth of the calories. And all this sits on a tiny, tiny base. I think there's maybe, I don't know, you can tell me, 5 or 6 wheat varieties being grown commercially. And people talk about, you know, a global collapse in grain production as we approach 1.5 degrees. We've already exceeded it, it seems. And when we hit 2 degrees or 2.5 degrees, that suddenly grain production is going to collapse and you're going to get global starvation.